It's easy to understand why a crowd gathered every time that Jesus healed the sick and performed other miracles. So why did so many people want to distance themselves from Jesus when he displayed his power over demons? We'll consider that with John MacArthur next on Grace to You. We often think of Jesus' words as healing and kind and soothing, and they were. But at times, no one had more terrifying things to say. In fact, at one point, Jesus' words were so fearfully powerful, the crowd around him asked him to leave. Sadly, they distanced themselves from the person they needed to know the most. Well, how do we make sure that that's not true of us? We'll consider the response to the staggering authority of Jesus today, as John MacArthur looks at the reaction folks in Jesus' day had to his power. The lesson you're about to hear on Grace to You is a part of John's current study called The Amazing Power of Jesus. And now with today's installment, here's John MacArthur.
Matthew chapter 8. Let's look at verse 28, the reception by the demons. The reception by the demons. And when he was come to the other side, into the country of the Gadarenes, there met him two possessed with demons, coming out of the tombs, exceedingly fierce, so that no man might pass by that way. Look where they were living in verse 28, these poor souls. Coming out of the tombs. Can you imagine? I mean, if I get near a graveyard at night walking down the street, I get the willies. But living in tombs? To a Jew, the number one defilement of all defilements was to touch a dead body. How far have these poor souls been driven that they should live in the tombs? And by the way, in that area where the cliffs are high on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, they were naturally hewn out and man-made chambers hewn out of the rocks for use as tombs, and there they were living in the tombs. And it says they were exceedingly fierce. It means violent. They were wild maniacs. And if you study the other accounts, it tells you more about them. In Luke 8, 27, it says they wore no clothes, stark naked. Now listen, I know people come along and say, oh, there's nothing wrong with that. I belong to the Sunshine Club. Well, in the Bible, the only people who went around naked were raving maniacs, if that's any help. They had no sense of social balance. They had no sense of modesty. They were wild maniacs. In Mark 5, it says they tried to bind them with chains, and no matter how strong the chains were, they broke the chains. They had a tremendous amount of strength. I'll never forget the girl we were dealing with two fingers, flipped the steel desk right over in the office on top of one of the men there. Tremendous strength. In Mark 5, it says they were screaming and shrieking and cutting themselves all over, gashing themselves and hacking away at their flesh with sharp stones. And they were shrieking all with loud screams. It says kradzo, which is an inarticulate shriek. Now you get kind of a picture, don't you? Stark naked, hacking themselves with stones, shrieking, racing down the hillside with incredible strength. And as a result, it says that no one might pass by that way. Well, I hope no one would ever go down there. No one go down that road. As soon as they did, out of the tombs they'd come, screaming down the hillside. But you know what happened? The reception of the demons. They saw the little boats, and they were ready to do their number. Out of the caves they came, screaming down the hill. And all of a sudden, something happened. And we find not only the reception by the demons, but the recognition by the demons. Verse 29. And behold, they cried out, saying, what have we to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God? Stop right there. What that really means in the Greek is, why are you bothering us? Why are you here? You know what it says in Mark? In Mark chapter 5 and verse 6, it says, when they saw Jesus, they worshiped him. Proskuneo. They prostrated themselves. They fell down. They worshiped. Incredible that they should worship Jesus. They did. Proskuneo means to kiss the hand, to reverence on the knees with the head to the ground. It is a word of profound awe, reverence, respect, and worship. You say, well, what are they doing that for? Because they know exactly who he is. Listen, demons are fallen angels. Once they were holy angels before they went into Satan's rebellion, and they were involved with God, and they know the second person of the Trinity. Nobody needs to help them with their Christology. They know, and they knew that he was their antagonist, and he was their judge, and he was their destroyer. And they said, why are you here to bother us? Are you come to torment us? Watch this. Before the time. Think of it. These beings are damned for all eternity. And they know it. And they despise Jesus. They loathe him. They hate him. And yet they worship him because they are forced to by his power. They can't resist it. You see, they know Philippians 2:10 that he is to be worshiped. And every knee is to bow, not only of things above the earth and on the earth, but things under the earth. They knew intuitively that they were standing in the presence of the second member of the Trinity. They knew intuitively that they were there with the Holy One of God, who had the power to destroy them. And they said, this can't be. The timing is wrong. They even know the redemptive plan. Listen, they're better theologians than most people. They know this is Christ, the Son of the living God. I know some cults that don't even know what the demons know. And they knew what the eschatological plan was. And they knew that they were to be doomed and damned forever. And so they bow the knee to Christ, their judge. How fascinating that is to me. It may also account for the fact that sometimes demons, through mediums and others, seem to be able to predict the future. It may be that somehow they've already been made aware of the divine plan. And at some points, they can anticipate what's going to happen. They're way ahead of even the Lord's disciples. The book of Revelation hasn't been written. The disciples weren't too sure when all this stuff was going to come to pass, but they knew. It's interesting to me, look at verse 29 again, that they address him as Jesus, thou Son of God. Oh my, what an important statement. Do you know that the Son of God is a term that is a synonym to Messiah? In Matthew 16:16, thou art, said Peter, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And that said the Father through Peter. That was God's revelation, that the Messiah is the Son of the living God. And so when they said, thou art the Son of God, they were saying, you're the King, you're the Messiah, you're the Anointed One, you're the Christ. You shouldn't be surprised. James 2:19 says the devils believe in what? And they tremble because they know the result. They know what's going to happen. In Luke 4:41, just let me read you a verse there. It says this, and demons also came out of many crying out, and here's what the demons said, thou art Messiah, the Son of God, for they knew that he was Christ. Great. They knew. They knew. And they knew they were doomed to the torment of an eternal hell. Following their reception and recognition, we come to their requisition in verse 30. They make a request. And it's bizarre. There was a good way off from them a herd of many pigs feeding. So the demons besought him, saying, if thou cast us out, and they knew it was inevitable, because they knew his tenderness and his love and compassion for one who was a captive. If you're going to do it, then let us go into the pigs. Now, what a strange request. Well, I mean, what good does that do? A demon-possessed pig, a pig is a pig is a pig, right? How do you tell a demon-possessed pig from any pig? What's the point? Well, you say, maybe demons need to be in something. Well, that's probably true. Maybe they do. But then again, we don't really know why they requested that. Maybe they like to have a home somewhere. Maybe they thought that was a nice concession. If you don't want us harming people, we'll just be content to go into pigs. But please don't send us to the pit. They fear Christ. They're in awe of him. They didn't want to go to the abyss. Just put us somewhere less precious. And about the least precious thing that they could think of would be pigs. By the way, Mark 5:13 says there were 2,000 of them in the herd. So it was a large herd of pigs. So there must have been a lot of demons. So we'll go into the herd of pigs. And really, that's all we know. We can only speculate about what they were thinking. Maybe they thought they'd go into the pigs and they'd sort of evade the pit. Maybe they thought, I'm sure they thought that, but maybe they thought they'd kill the pigs and get everybody mad at Jesus and they'd kill Jesus for killing their pigs. But whatever, they had their little plan. But most interesting is Jesus' response. And we move from the possession of the demons to the power of Christ in verse 32. Now we take our focus off the demons and onto Christ. And he said unto them, go. You want to know something? When men try to cast out demons, they got to work hard to get the demons to cooperate. When Christ comes, they want to go. All they want to know is where they're allowed to go. And he said, go. And when they were gone out or come out, they went into the herd of swine. And behold, the whole herd of swine ran violently down a steep place into the sea and perished in the waters. They all went right off the cliff, right down to the sea and all drowned. 2,000 pigs. Now, let me just have you think about this for a minute. How did he cast out all these demons? He said, go, that's all. He said, go. When he appeared, they wanted to leave. And he commanded them to leave. Be gone, one word. Now, that is the thing that shocked everybody. It wasn't that he did it. It was how he did it. Instantaneously and totally. And you have to understand, people, that these demons are powerful, powerful beings. Men cannot deal with them. We can't deal on the supernatural level. You know, it's so silly for people to run around thinking they can cast out demons by their cleverness. The demons are way ahead of you on that. In 2 Peter 2:11, it says, angels are greater in power and might than men. In Psalm 103, the angels excel in strength. You say, well, the demons, are they as powerful as the holy angels? Well, they must be in one sense, because in Daniel, we've seen in chapter 10 that a holy angel came with a dispatch message from God to Daniel, but a demon held him up for 3 weeks, and God had to send Michael to let him go. They're powerful. In fact, in Ephesians 6, it says, if we're going to handle them, we have to put on the armor of God. We have to be strong in his might. Demons are powerful. One holy angel in 2 Kings 19, verse 35, it says, slew 185,000 Assyrians in one shot. So they far surpass men. They have superior intelligence. That's obvious from Ezekiel 28. They have superior strength. You can see that right with this maniac in Mark 5 who kept breaking the chains. You can see it in Acts 19, Matthew 17. They have superior power. They can do signs and wonders according to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. They have a superior scope. That is, they range across the heavens according to Daniel 10. They have superior experience. They have lived from before the creation of man. They have been living through all the annals of human history. They've been around a long time and they know what they're about and they understand how men function and think. They have superior nature. They are spirit beings. They're not bound by any form. And so these are incredible creatures. Only the Lord Christ could bruise the serpent's head. Only the Lord Christ can cast them into the pit in Revelation 20. And only he can deal with them here. And so he gives them their request, but not for their sake, but for his. He sends them right into that herd of pigs. Now people say, why did he do that? Why did he do? Some people say, well, because they shouldn't have been raising those pigs and it was a good lesson. Well, I don't think that's the lesson here. I don't think the lesson here is a lesson about should you or shouldn't you raise pigs. I don't think that's the lesson. The lesson here is that Christ can cast out demons. How are you going to demonstrate they left? Just look at a normally peaceful herd of pigs. Pigs don't usually swim. And they're not sheep, they don't all go somewhere together. And watch 2,000 of them race toward a cliff, go off the edge, and all dive in the water and drown. And the conclusion is something supernatural just happened. And if at the same split second you turn around and the two demonized individuals are sitting and, as Mark says, clothed and in their right minds, having a wonderful conversation with Jesus, the connection is readily, easily made. You see, what he did was give a living demonstration of the deliverance of those two men that no one would ever forget. At the same time, it did demonstrate the destructive nature of demons. For when demons hit those pigs, instantly they were all destroyed. And I believe it gave to the demons a preview of their own coming destruction. And if you're concerned about the pigs, you've missed the point. There's lots more pigs for folks. We can sacrifice a few thousand pigs for Jesus to maintain this demonstration of incredible power. I believe that he wanted a living proof that those demons came out of those men. And he sent them in to those animals that those animals might put on a demonstration that nobody would ever forget. That leads us to the final point, the perspective of the people. How did they react? How did they react? By the way, it says in verse 32, interesting footnote, they ran violently down a steep place. Same thought as in verse 28, that the demon-possessed people were exceedingly fierce. The fierceness and the violence was transferred to the pigs. And there must have been as much maniacal behavior in those pigs as there had been in those men, so that the link was clear in the minds of the people as to what had happened. Verse 33, and they that kept them fled. Now, they aren't the owners. They're just the swineherds, the people that cared for the pigs out on the hills. And men, when they saw that their pigs had all committed mass suicide and they'd run down that hill like maniacs into the water, they went their ways into the city. They fled. They sped. They flew. They blew out of there as fast as they could go. And they told everything and what was befallen to their pigs. Is that what it says? Oh, no. What was befallen to those, what? Possessed with demons. In other words, they got the message. The pigs weren't the issue. The issue was the men were delivered from the demons. The pigs were only the proof. That's all. So they went in and said, this is what happened. They told everything. And what happened? Verse 34. Behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus. Oh, isn't that great? Real revival. And there were the guys sitting there clothed and in their right minds having a conversation with the Lord. How did they react? The whole city came. Well, when they saw him, they worshiped him. No, they were frankly one step behind the demons. They besought him that he would depart from their borders. Get out. Get out. Why did they say that? Every commentary I read said because they were more concerned about their pigs than Jesus. Because they were consummate materialists. We want our pigs. How dare you do this? Rather than being concerned as spiritualists about the souls of these two demonized men. But those aren't the right answers. You want to know something? It doesn't say a word about the owners of the pigs. None of the three records says anything about the reaction of the owners of the pigs. These are not the owners of the pigs. This is the whole city. And the whole city came out, and when they saw him, they said, get out of here. Why? Mark 5:15, they were afraid. They were not mad. They were not angry. They were scared to death. In Luke 8:37, same account, they were overcome with panic. When unholy men face a holy God, they are in terror. We're right back to Isaiah 6. Woe is me. Woe, that's the word of a curse. Isaiah, the best man in the land, pronounced a curse on himself when he saw God because his unholiness was exposed. Peter, when he saw Jesus Christ in the majesty of his power, said, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man, O Lord. When the storm came, they were afraid. And when Jesus stilled the storm, they were exceedingly afraid. They were more afraid of the calm than they were of the storm because they knew God was in their boat. and they were in awe of God. They saw the supernatural and it panicked them. They saw one who could control the demons. They saw one who could control animals. They saw one who could take the soul of a man and give it back to him as white and pure as the driven snow. And they were scared to death. They saw God is what they saw. I don't know if they all understood that, but they knew it was supernatural. And men don't like that. It makes them uncomfortable. Give us back our pigs and go away. Men can handle pigs. They can't handle God. The mystery of the supernatural, they can't handle. They saw him. They saw the power. They were absolutely panicked in awe of God. And instead of falling at his feet in worship, they said, get out. Go away. We don't want you. People say, oh, you know, if you could just see the miracles, you'd believe. Listen, the people who saw the miracles didn't believe. They nailed him to a cross. And they'd seen miracle after miracle after miracle after miracle. They still didn't believe. It just made them hate him more and more and more and more. People think today if they can just show everybody a pile of miracles, everybody will believe. No, because some people, when exposed in the presence of the awesomeness of holy God, will literally run because they love their darkness. You know, have you ever picked up a rock and found a whole lot of little bugs under it that have been there for a long time, and as soon as you expose them to the light, they just split? Try to find a hole. That's just the way men are. You expose them to the light of God and they love their darkness, they'll go right back into the earth to find it again. And that's where these were. But God was very gracious to them. The story ends in Mark 5:19, the parallel account, and you have to listen to these two verses. It says this, the demon-possessed wanted to go with Jesus. He wanted to travel with Jesus. He wanted to get back in the boat and go with him. But Jesus allowed him not. Mark 5:19 said he wouldn't let him go. Said to him this, go home to your friends, tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and hath had compassion on you. And he departed and began to publish in Decapolis, and that was the territory there, what great things Jesus had done for him, and all men did marvel. You know what he did? Those hating people who wanted Jesus out of their country never did break Jesus' compassion or mercy for them. So he left them. This one lone missionary and his friend as living proof in their midst of his mighty power. A missionary. How wonderful that the grace of Christ is extended to those who don't even want it.
Been listening to John MacArthur here on Grace to You as he continued his look at the power that Jesus Christ has over all of creation, including the spiritual realm. The title of John's current study from Matthew chapter 8, The Amazing Power of Jesus. Certainly, we're all in desperate need of spiritual healing, like the man that Jesus encountered in today's passage. But John, it's also true that our most fundamental need is what the people of Decapolis ran from, a clear vision of Jesus' power, holiness, and perfection.
I can't tell you how true that is, Carl. The heart and soul of living the Christian life is knowing Christ. Knowing Christ. It's not about knowing formulas. It's not about playing psychological games. The power in the Christian life, the power of sanctification, is the power of love. And it's the power of loving Christ. And loving Christ is directly connected to knowing Christ. The more we know him, the more we love him. The more we love him, the more we keep his commandments. Absolutely, a clear vision of the person of Jesus, his power, his holiness, his perfection, is at the very heart of living the Christian life. Growing in sanctification is growing in the knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. That's what the New Testament says. And that has always been my preoccupation, to put Christ before people and watch the sanctification take place in response. In line with that, I want to mention a brand new book called One Perfect Life. And there has only been one lived on this earth, and that is the life of the Lord Jesus Christ. But One Perfect Life looks at him in a way that's never been done before. It takes the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and blends them together in one narrative account. Really, the heart and soul of the Bible is the four Gospels. But when you read them separately, it's kind of hard to weave the story together. So I've done that for you after 25-plus years of studying and preaching through those Gospels so that it comes as one narrative story. The title of the book, about 500 pages, One Perfect Life, and it has some study notes at the bottom to explain the text. It's hardcover, available from Grace to You. I promise you, from my own experience, you're going to love reading the life of Christ in a fresh way that you've never heard before.
When you see the story of Christ in one complete chronological narrative, you're going to be captivated afresh by His majesty. Get a copy for yourself. Get one for a friend, too, maybe an unbeliever. Again, order One Perfect Life. Mention that as you go online or contact us by phone today. To purchase your copy of One Perfect Life, go on to the website gty.org or call this toll-free number. It's available anytime, 1-800-55-GRACE. The cost for the book is $15. Shipping is free. And again, this book weaves together every verse about Jesus, including the details pulled from the Old Testament, into a seamless narrative. To get your copy of One Perfect Life, go online to gty.org or call 1-800-55-GRACE. Of course, this new book is one of dozens that we have available. You can also purchase a copy of the MacArthur Study Bible or any of John's 29 New Testament commentaries. Dozens of books and CD albums also available. Place your order online anytime, gty.org. And then thank you, too, for remembering that we depend on listeners' gifts to be on radio and for handling everything that we do. If we're making a difference in your life, please let us know through your support. Write today to Grace to You, Post Office Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. Or call 1-800-55-GRACE. For John MacArthur and the staff, I'm your host, Carl Miller, wishing you a great weekend, thanking you for joining us today, and reminding you to watch Grace to You television. It's seen Sundays on DirecTV, Channel 378, or you can watch it online anytime at gty.org. Then do join us next week as John continues unleashing God's truth, one verse at a time, here on Grace to You. What is the most important message you can share with others, and why does that message have everything to do with the amazing power of Jesus? More to consider on Monday's Grace to You.